Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Casey Seiler, state editor and Capital Bureau chief for the Albany Times-Union and one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now, a statewide political program. Welcome back, Casey. Always great to have you here. And before we begin, congratulations on one of the best pieces of journalism I have ever seen in my life. And that is, as we speak now, just a little while back, we had a wonderful article sort of exploring in great detail the way in which politics in New York State works, and we're going to talk about that today.
That is high praise, and thank you very much for saying that.
Well, Casey, let's start out by saying, what's the premise of that article?
Well, this is a recent report that Chris Bragg, who is our investigative reporter covering the Capitol, and I worked on, that looks at sort of two things, you know, a quid and a quo, if you will, involving...
In this case, a Cuomo.
I will leave you to draw those connections, but...
Yes.
A set of political contributions given by a Kingston-based developer named Stephen Aaron, who runs a company named Burchez Associates. Like many real estate developers, Mr. Aaron is associated with a number of other companies, including limited liability companies that have been discussed so much when the topic comes to ethics and political giving.
Because the famous LLCs.
The famous LLC loopholes. LLCs, yeah. If you are a businessman who controls a great deal of LLCs or a woman, you can multiply the force of your political giving because each LLC can give up to the individual maximum. And Mr. Aaron, this Kingston-based developer, has given the governor since the beginning of 2010, so basically to the governor's two gubernatorial campaigns, more than $250,000. Or to be more accurate, he can be linked to $262,000 in contributions. None of them in his own name, none of them in the name of Burchez Associates, although both he and his company are generous political donors on a much smaller scale to lots of politicians. All of these have come, all these donations to Cuomo, with the exception of $25,000 that his wife gave the governor, have come through companies that he is associated with that you can link him to through the address of his business down in Kingston, P.O. boxes that are shared by several different donating entities. So that's a lot of money.
There's a lot of dark music, as in the movies, playing in the background as you describe all of this.
I will leave it to your outstanding engineers to add that after the fact. Now, the other side of this is that Mr. Aaron's developments, several of them, have gotten tax breaks, tax credits for these affordable housing projects that he works on that are generous, that can mean a great deal to a real estate developer who works in this field. Many of these projects, or a couple of these projects, I should say, initially got low grades from the staff of the State Division of Housing and Community Renewal, DHCR. Those initial low grades were overcome, if you will, by what's called a commissioner's determination. In this case, since the governor took office from Darrell Towns, who was the housing commissioner, who would essentially write these letters that basically said, yes, this project got a low staff grade, but for these reasons, which we will enumerate, we believe that this project is still worthy and should get this tax credit.
So I guess the question then is, first of all, when they do something like that, even though they've given money through all their LLCs, are they in fact getting more back than they were giving?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's a very important point to remember.
The amount of the contribution, at least the ones that we were able to find, is much lower than the benefit to the project, because these tax credits, in many cases, can go on for, they're not just a simple lump sum, in other words, money in a briefcase or a grant or something like that. They are a credit that is annualized, that goes on for 10 years. So if you get a $400,000 credit, that's actually $400,000 over the course of 10 years, which the developer can then take out to investors and say, look, I got this credit. Come and get it. In other words, it then becomes a benefit that is attractive to investors who want to put money into the project. Now, none of that is necessarily inherently sleazy or wrong or corrupt. There are
It may not be corrupt, but it certainly may be sleazy.
Once again, I will leave that to you. You are editorializing. The story that Chris and I wrote is my favorite kind of story because it's exclusively based on documents. Documents from the Board of Elections, documents from DCHR, as well as on-the-record interviews that we have had with, you know, people who have been involved with Mr. Aaron, or court documents related to some legal difficulties that he has been involved in.
Okay. Well, let me just say, again, I thought this is one of the best pieces of journalism I've ever seen. But in addition to that, you talked about the economic development councils around the state. What are they?
These are the 10 regional economic development councils that the governor set up pretty much almost immediately, not long after he took office in 2011. And these have basically been used to, as the governor would put it, kind of streamline and centralize what used to be a real kind of crazy quilt of requests that the state would get for aid. It would also, or it has also, kind of supplanted what used to be known as the member item system in many cases. This was kind of political pork, where essentially the elected officials in the legislature, the majority, of course, in each house, would get the biggest pot of money, and they could dole it out within their district. Governor David Patterson really kind of shut that system down. It was rife for abuse. Governor Cuomo has continued to speak out against and block any kind of expansion. Critics say that the Regional Economic Development Council system in some ways has essentially kind of centralized it with the executive chamber, which has a great deal of power over allocating who gets these grants, these tax credits. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars each year, and we have a new round of these coming up this year, likely in December. This year, there's actually a supersized version of that competition for upstate. $1.5 billion in grants and credits will be handed out, $500 million apiece, to 3 out of 7 upstate regional economic development councils. And it's been referred to, I think, as the upstate Hunger Games. It's a lot of economic development money. The Capital Region is, of course, competing. All these plans went in just a couple of weeks ago, and now they're being assessed and weighed by a judging panel that is, you know, in large part controlled by the governor.
I think that's the important point here, Casey, and you make it so well in your piece, that while these economic development councils have been set up to do a lot of the vetting, in the end, it's the governor's offices, his agencies, that are going to make these decisions. I think you said something which really struck me, and was that the councils get 20% of the influence, while the governor's office gets, or the governor's people, get 80%.
The governor's people, including agency, you know, agency voices and that kind of thing. This year, the judging panel includes a couple of elected officials as well. But I don't think there's any question that the executive branch really holds the whip hand in that adjudication process.
So I want to talk to you, in addition to some of the things that have been happening in New York politics. One of them is a new Siena poll that has come out and shows Governor Cuomo, you know, at a fairly low level of approval for his work, as opposed to general feelings about him. You take a general feeling about Cuomo, he's got about 50%. That's not unusual. When you take...
Yes, favorability rating sits right at 50%, which is not, of course, a majority, almost, though.
But when you talk about his specific positions, that's where he doesn't do well.
Right. Performance on individual issues, his performance ratings are kind of middling at best. And that includes his ratings on ethics, education, some of the biggest issues, I think transportation as well was included in there. So, yeah, just kind of middling scores at best. And the problem for the governor is that he has been working so hard, really, especially over the course of the summer, to kind of shore up in the months since the legislative session ended. He's worked so hard to shore up his support among progressives, including most recently with his announcement that he's going to essentially make an end run around the legislature on the provisions, the protections for transgendered individuals that are included in the legislation called GENDA, which has been blocked in the Senate for so long. The governor is essentially going to impose those by executive fiat, but he just can't seem to get that much traction. It's not resulting in an increase in his numbers kind of statewide.
Okay, so one of the things he's done is to talk now about education. And it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, I know you always will, Casey, that in the beginning, he was all for accountability. He was for testing. Along comes, you know, this concept of No Child Left Behind. And he now has basically switched his position.
He has definitely walked away from placing an emphasis on testing as the undergirding, the necessary student testing is the undergirding for the teacher evaluation system,
exactly.
The much more rigorous teacher evaluation system that he has called for, you know, year after year, especially in his first term, every year, I think, climaxing almost, I believe it was two State of the States ago, when the governor really took it to teachers and took it to, you know, what he would refer to as the public education lobby, which basically meant teachers' unions, and called on lawmakers to really toughen up the system. Now, of course, we have the federal government walking away from or warning the states to decrease their emphasis on student testing. But of course, if you have less student testing, you got to come up with a different metric for teacher evaluations. That's why the Regents has been in such turmoil over the course of the last two legislative sessions.
And in fact, you know, for a guy who was so intent on taking on the teachers, I happen to believe that was a huge part of his loss of popularity. He really has sort of retreated, hasn't he?
I think it's too early to tell because he has called a Common Core Reform Task Force, his second, to come together to provide him with ideas that he can roll out, concepts that he can roll out in the coming legislative session. So we'll have to see what they come up with. The governor is, of course, very fond of creating commissions. Quite often, the proposals that they come up with are symmetrical to the governor's own thoughts and desires. So we'll see what comes out of that. The Regents just announced that they are also creating a panel to look at tweaks, overhauls, perhaps to the teacher evaluation system that was really kind of foisted on them in the recent legislative session, and that they kind of almost grudgingly accepted, that they accepted while at the same time saying that the legislature needs to come back in 2016 and essentially fix the problems.
Okay, so let's talk about ethics for a moment, Casey. The governor obviously blew it with the Moral Enact Commission. We know that now. And Preet Bharara was not silent, the U.S. attorney,
right,
about what he felt about all of that. And when, you know, despite the fact that he tried to own ethics reform, the governor did in the very beginning, it didn't really work out. But people seem to understand that he, by killing the Moral Enact Commission, he really wasn't being genuine about ethics reform.
I think that is absolutely a fair assessment. I mean, that was really the major wound to his first term. The shutting down of the Moreland Commission really just almost exactly halfway through its planned existence, 9 out of a planned 18 months. The governor said that he got back, a host of improved ethics reforms. Those were seen as being kind of meager at best.
Yeah.
The governor, in the most recent session, that was, of course, just racked by ethical problems, the arrests of, you know, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, now former Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos. And his response to Silver's arrest, Skelos's arrest had not yet happened, was to basically lay down the law and say, there are 5 things that I absolutely must get included or along with the state budget, the current year state budget, or I'm not going to sign it. 5 ethics fixes. And good government groups criticized them as being fairly minimal in scope. One that was left off the list, which cycles back around to the story that Chris Bragg and I just reported on, is closure of the LLC loophole, this loophole that allows so much money to flow from big moneyed interests, including real estate interests. The governor was asked why, actually I asked the governor why he didn't include that in his, you know, Cuomo ultimatum during budget season, and he said, well, I want to make the five things I ask for to be absolutely, you know, bulletproof, armor-plated, that nobody could argue against it. And the follow-up question is, what's the argument in favor of maintaining the LLC loophole? And there really isn't a good one, except for the notion that it helps to balance out giving by labor groups. That is what the business community says. We need the LLC loophole to balance out the, as they put it, disproportional political giving power of unions.
Yeah, the last thing we want is democracy. So let's talk a little bit about guns. You ride around upstate, you see signs that say repeal the SAFE Act.
To this day.
Yeah, right. And so with gun owners, the SAFE Act, Cuomo's signature act, which I applaud him for, is seen as a hateful thing. And yet, when out comes the Siena poll, the majority of New Yorkers, I think by a lot, think that his work on guns, circumscribing all of that, is good.
Yeah, correct. Upstate, of course, those numbers are a lot lower. That's not exactly a big surprise. There's more of the state's Republican population is upstate. But if you talk about Moreland being one of the big wounds of his first term, among Republicans and those sort of more on the right who had supported Cuomo because, of course, of his, you know, fiscal promises and everything else in the 2010 elections, that was the wound. That was Cuomo's big wound from his first term. Of course, he to this day calls it one of his proudest accomplishments.
And he should.
Right. And in the wake of the recent string of, you know, these horrible mass killings, Cuomo, and we should also point out the shooting on Labor Day of one of his former aides, Corey Gabay. Cuomo has really taken a much louder, taller national stance, going out there talking on numerous national outlets about what he did with the SAFE Act, scolding Congress for not doing a better job, scolding other states for not doing what he did with the SAFE Act. But even so, you're right, it continues to be very controversial. Many people say that, you know, they kind of cast around looking for signs that it is actually doing what it set out to do.
Let's go back, if we can, to education for a minute, and Merrill Tisch, one of the most important, influential families in New York, and the Tisches, and she has been the head of the Board of Regents for all this time, and obviously a favorite of Sheldon Silver, now in some disgrace.
And correct.
So Sheldon Silver is out, and apparently so is Merrill Tisch as the chair. Do we have any idea whether one and one made two there?
I don't think Silver's fall necessarily led to Tisch's decision to leave the Regents when her current term ends in March.
So you don't think she was told your time is up?
No, I think she has had, I don't know that for a fact, but I know for a fact that the last couple of years for her have been such a rough ride that, and she has been on the Board of Regents for, I believe, 20 years, including, I think, six, almost seven, as chancellor. It's a chancellor. Yeah. So I don't think it's at all surprising that she is looking to get out. You mentioned that she is obviously was a favorite of Sheldon Silver. That is because, of course, the chancellor is selected by the regents. The regents are selected by a vote of the entire 213-member legislature. And because Assembly Democrats, a little bit more than 100 members, have such a clear numeric majority in the whole two-house body, that means that they basically get to call the tune. They can basically pick the regents, which the Senate is not too happy about, of course.
And then, of course, we have the iron law of oligarchy, which means that if the Democrats get to pick the chancellor, then there's always one guy who runs all the Democrats. And in this case, it was Shelley Silver. Now it's Carl Hastie.
Correct.
The present speaker.
I did a column during the 2014 round of regents elections. And a regent got elected who nobody had ever met until, I think, 2 days, 3 days, maybe even one day before her nomination was put on the floor and she was approved. That's the regent that represents the Capital Region right now. And I said to one lawmaker, I can't believe how, you know, this person managed to very quickly get on the Board of Regents. And what this lawmaker said back to me was, if I want this regent to do something, I'm going to call Sheldon Silver. And that, I think, was a very frank way of, you know, kind of diagramming exactly the lines of influence that you're talking about.
Let's talk a little bit about the de Blasio-Cuomo split. I've never understood Andrew Cuomo on this one. Never, ever. I don't understand why he beats him up the way that he does, whether it's sadistic or bullying. But I've always thought that this is not helpful to either man. And now we see that de Blasio himself has decided to endorse Hillary Clinton. Big deal, but...
He is about to.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Blasio held out. I think most of us think de Blasio decided that without Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren involved, he would be the standard bearer for the progressives in the United States. And it hasn't quite worked out. And therefore, he said he was not prepared to endorse Hillary for quite a while. Now he is. What's happened?
I think... it's exactly what you're talking about, that if he wants to be the progressive firebrand, if he wants to kind of hold the banner, he can't exactly leap aboard the Hillary Clinton Express too early. He has, of course, never said anything bad about her. He has, all he said is, I'm waiting to hear more specific proposals, which is, you know, not exactly a bad thing. And frankly, this whole kind of gavotte of does Bill de Blasio support Hillary Clinton or not is really a little bit silly.
I couldn't agree more.
And frankly, Hillary Clinton would probably benefit and probably does benefit from the fact that her her endorsements are not all essentially rushing for the door, as it were, but are kind of being doled out. You know, isn't it better, instead of having 50 endorsements in July, you know, a year and a half before the election, isn't it better to kind of parcel them out a little bit, especially when there hasn't even been a primary yet? So I think it's a bit dopey.
Casey Seiler, we don't have much more time, but I did want to ask you, we have a presidential election coming up soon.
It's not for a year.
But
it's not
year.
Coming up soon.
Well, that, in
it
my
kills
book,
me.
As a 74-year-old, yes. It's, you know, it's coming up soon.
Yeah.
So the question is, will it be a realigning election so that the Democrats take both houses? We know they're going to take the Assembly, but take the Senate too.
That is what the Senate Democrats are hoping for, without a doubt. They see things like, you know, the arrest of Dean Skelos. They see the guilty verdict against Tom Libous of Binghamton, who was the deputy majority leader.
And yet, let me stop you right there. There's no appetite for electing a Democrat, even though their guy goes to jail. There's no appetite for electing a Democrat in that district.
In the Southern Tier.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Barbara Fiala encountered great difficulty, despite or perhaps because of the strong support of Governor Andrew Cuomo. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's a reminder that all politics is local and people do not vote for a Democratic state Senate. They vote for the candidate who is running in their district. But certainly with a popular Democratic candidate, a former, you know, U.S. senator from New York running at the top of the ticket, Senate Democrats are hoping that's going to bring out a lot of Democratic voters and could make the difference in swinging the Senate. But we should remember that even if the Senate is swung, we still have to reunify the independent Democratic conference with, or they have to reunify with the independent Democratic conference.
These are the so-called traitors, the one who went over to make common cause with the Republicans.
So-called by some, Jeff Klein and the IDC.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right. And some of the people who had been elected as Democrats who lost in the off year, basically, non-presidential gubernatorial year, those people are now in a position to come back again and get their old seats back, the ones who lost, the Democrats.
Yes, correct. In other words, the Republicans who were booted are going to come back. But
No. The Democrats who were booted in the last election, people like Kachik and some of these other names that are not familiar to anybody.
Yes. In other words, any former office holder has a chance to come back. But the advantages of incumbency in the legislature cannot be overstated.
We are out of time. Our guest has been Casey Seiler, state editor and Capitol Bureau chief for the Albany Times-Union. Casey is one of the hosts of Public Television's New York Now, a statewide political program. Casey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.